Will the House please come to order? Representative Lockhart, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's with pleasure I introduce to this group one of the greater House members that have ever been here. He's a specialist on tax exemption and not liking them. And with that, I'd like to ask Bob Tanner to step up to the microphone and share with us how we can do away with those tax exemptions and welcome him to the House.
Yay! Welcome, Bob.
Thank you very much. It is a privilege to be here. At least I think it is. And to remind you that tax exemptions were the bane of my existence and still are, I had the privilege of introducing 16 bills to remove tax exemptions, and I came out a winner, 1 in favor, 15 opposed. So my success at removing exemptions is not good. And I wish somebody would take that cause up and see if they could improve on that for a little. And yes, Representative Madden, I applaud you. Keep up the good work. And thanks much for your warm welcome and good luck. I know you have a lot of things to do. Oh, yes, we are offering a little hospitality this evening, should any of you care to join us at Little America with the Realtors.
Thank you, Representative Tanner. I remember those debates well. Chairman Cohey, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I recall them being one-sided debates. Mr. Speaker, I would like to introduce 6 new Highway Patrol troopers who will be assigned to various positions around the state after graduation ceremonies this coming Friday. These troopers will fill following vacant slots across the state. The recruits will take an oath of office administered by the Wyoming Supreme Court justices this coming Friday. To get to this point in their new careers, the recruits have taken pre-employment written exams, oral interviews, physical agility testing, psychological reviews, medical exams, and background checks. Finally, the recruits have successfully completed 25 weeks of intensive instruction in Wyoming and constitutional law, physical training, marksmanship, commercial carrier laws, radar, crash investigation, and numerous other courses. They will complete a 50-day field training period before being allowed to patrol on their own. Their names are and postings are: John T. Briggs will be assigned to Rollins. Matthew R. Leet will be assigned to Newcastle. Rodney Myers to Basin, Wyoming. Jason Sodden to my hometown of Casper. Matthew D. Veeley to Rock Springs. And John B. Weitzel to Rock Springs. Please make them feel welcome.
Welcome to the House of Representatives, gentlemen, and congratulations, and thank you for your service. We appreciate it. Representative Pedersen, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple of introductions, and I suppose that it's also appropriate that they're on opposing sides of the House. Up here on my right side is my business and life mentor, my father, Pete Pedersen. And on the left side is the father of the most beautiful woman I've ever met in my life, my father-in-law, John Parr.
Welcome, Pete and John. Hopefully you can have dinner together sometime. Representative Gilmore, you may have privilege of the floor.
Well, unfortunately, the patrolman just left. I wanted to point out to him what they'll look like after serving 30 years on the Wyoming Highway Patrol. Rick Dye from Casper and various other places in Wyoming, and I understand now he's a bus driver for the Natrona County School District, and I can imagine those kids had to sit at attention riding in his bus the whole way. So lighten up on them, Rick, and welcome to the House.
Welcome. Welcome to the House, Rick. Representative Davison, you may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to introduce someone from that doesn't get down here very often from the southwest corner of Wyoming, Cameron, our city administrator, Mike Archibald. He's right above here. Thank you.
Welcome to the House, Mike. We are at that order of business of reports from standing committees after Representative Chairman Berger
Thank
has privilege
you,
of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for privilege of the floor. I just wanted to announce to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not turned in your RSVP for the Governor's Prayer Breakfast, which is on February 26th at 7 a.m., the session's going quickly, and it's at Little America. So if you'd like to get that taken care of, and we'll have a good head count. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Mr. Reading Clerk, reports from standing committees.
House, Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 33, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Esquivel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 78, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Edmonds, Esquivel, Goggles, Madden, Peterson. No, Anderson, Miller, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 115, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Edmonds, Esquivel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson. No, Anderson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 59, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. No, Brechtel, excused, Roscoe. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 60, respectfully reports back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 93, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, no, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 97, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 106, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Esquivel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 111, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
Are there any re-referrals? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to re-refer 3 House Bills, 97, 93, and 111 to your committee number 2, Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We're at that order of business of Senate files on first reading. First NFL for our consideration is Senate File 3.
Senate File 3 introduced by the Agriculture Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to apiaries.
Senate File 3 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 10.
Senate File 10 introduced by the Travel Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state parks regarding Bear River State Park.
Senate File 10 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 11.
Senate File 11 introduced by the Travel Committee. An act.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state parks and cultural resources and disposition of lands.
Senate File 11 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 12.
Senate File 12 introduced by the Travel Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to state parks and historic sites, boundaries, and designations.
Senate File 12 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 43.
Senate File 43 introduced by Senator Meyer.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to game and fish, special hunting season extension.
Senate File 43 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47.
Senate File 47 introduced by Senator Schiffer.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to paramutual wagering.
Senate File 47 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 4.
Senate File 4 introduced by the Corporation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to special districts.
Senate File 4 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 5.
Senate File 5 introduced by the Corporation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to special districts and other specified public entities.
Senate File 5 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 6.
Senate File 6 introduced by the Corporation Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to improvement and service districts.
Senate File 6 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 8.
Senate File 8 introduced by the Judiciary Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to child support and medical support of children.
Senate File 8 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 14.
Senate File 14 introduced by the Judiciary Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to juvenile circuit court hearings of municipal violations by juveniles.
Senate File 14 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 19.
Senate File 19 introduced by Senator Ross.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to driving under the influence.
Senate File 19 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 16.
Senate File 16, introduced by the Revenue Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to property tax review of assessment and taxation and revenue.
Senate File 16 is referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 17.
Senate File 17, introduced by the Revenue Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to property statement of consideration.
Senate File 17 is referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 28.
Senate File 28, introduced by Senator Martin.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to intergovernmental cooperation.
Senate File 28 is referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 20.
Senate File 20, introduced by Senator Escobel.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to motor vehicles, text-based communications prohibited while driving.
Senate File 20 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 40.
Senate File 40, introduced by Senator Cooper.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to establishment of highways.
Senate File 40 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 23.
Senate File 23, introduced by the Labor Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to unemployment compensation.
Senate File 23 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 24.
Senate File 24, introduced by Senator Martin.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to community-based in-home services for seniors.
Senate File 24 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 41.
Senate File 41, introduced by the Education Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program.
Senate File 41 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 42.
Senate File 42, introduced by the Education Committee.
first reading of the bill.
An act relating to school finance, student enrichment instruction.
Senate File 42 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 45.
Senate File 45, introduced by Senator Jennings.
Senate File 45 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Chairman McComey and Chairman Cohey, if you have a difference of opinion as to where that bill should go, whether it's transportation or education, please let me know. First reading of the bill, excuse me.
An act relating to school buses.
Okay, let me do that again. Senate File 45 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education, and if you two believe that it should be in transportation, that would be fine. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 46.
Senate File 46, introduced by the School Facility Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to charter schools.
Senate File 46 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education.
I can do it now if you want. Whatever.
We are at that order of business of consideration of bills on general file, but Mr. Majority Floor Leader, Representative Hales, you may have privilege of the floor.
It's my real pleasure to introduce to you in the West Balcony the ninth grade U.S. history class from Kelly Walsh High School with their teacher, Sally O'Brien. Give them a great welcome.
Yay!
Welcome to the House of Representatives. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House resolve itself into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed, no. We are resolved into Committee of the Whole. Representative Moniz.
The Committee of the Whole, please come to order. The first bill for consideration is House Bill 12. The reading clerk will read the bill. House Bill 18.
House Bill 18, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish, aquatic invasive species 2.
You've heard the... I'm sorry, Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 18 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I'll turn the podium over to the good representative from Laramie to cover the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I'm tempted to start this out with the line, "Don't move a muscle." That is, Now wait. That was the leading line used by the good chairman's grandson when he gave a presentation to our committee about this bill, and he did such a wonderful job. When we finished and passed the bill out, the chairman said, "Who should carry it on the floor?" And we all pointed at the good chairman's grandson, and the chairman had to call a point of order. That is a very good opening line about this bill. I want to make some general comments, and then I'll go through it in detail. We're talking here about aquatic invasive species. These are mussels, two mussels in particular, zebra mussels and quagga mussels. These are very small. I think you all saw at one time or another that piece of pipe that I had that had the mussels attached to it. And they, once they establish themselves in a body of water, they're extremely harmful. And I hope everybody's had, I don't want to belabor this thing, I think everybody's had an opportunity now to understand how harmful they can be. This is a bill with a significant appropriation attached to it in a session where we don't have a lot of excess money. I was asked today why, in fact, I've been asked several times, why should we spend this money, substantial amount, as it stands today, is $2.5 million to the Game and Fish for the biennium. And after the Appropriations Committee haircut, and that standing amendment hasn't been made yet, but it will, it cuts it down to $500,000 for state parks, so we're at $3 million. The $500,000 for state parks is for 1 year. The $2.5 million to the Game and Fish is for the biennium. And that, so we're talking about $3 million with another supplemental appropriation for state parks coming next year. Certainly a lot of money. And the question was asked, why should we spend that money? And the short answer is there's no remediation for these things. There's no known way to eradicate them. Once they infect a water supply, they're there, and we're going to have to deal with them from there on. Beyond that, the question comes up, well, why should we spend that money when they're probably going to get here anyway? I think that our Game and Fish people would like to believe that that's not true. However, it is true. There was an initiative called the 100th Meridian Initiative that was used at one time to try to draw a line at the 100th Meridian, which is roughly the Mississippi River, or a little bit this side of it. They did hold them there for a long time, and that meridian was finally breached. And so the question comes up, well, they're probably going to get here sooner or later anyway. We're going to have them. Why are we going to spend so much money trying to prevent the inevitable? The answer to that is, I'm told, that once they're here, the cost of dealing with them will exceed the cost that we're going to incur trying to keep them out. So each year's prevention budget is a good investment because it's another year that we don't have to deal with the mussels. And once the mussels get here, the price is going up. So each year's prevention would be cheaper than that year's treatment of the mussels. This is pervasive. Some of the things we learned in committee about these, clearly it affects sport fishing. Clearly it affects intake systems to water treatment plants. It affects irrigation facilities. A number of our members have been in some of the states that have these and have seen the problems. But it's even more pervasive than that. One of the things that I had not understood was that power plants, to deal with these, probably have to build redundant intake structures. And I assume that water treatment facilities will have to do the same thing. So instead of having a single intake structure for cooling water, they're going to have to be two intake structures so that one can be taken down and cleaned while the other's up, and then vice versa. Well, that's a cost that runs deep. And it's a cost that we're going to see in increased budgets from cities and towns, counties, almost any state enterprise that we fund. So hopefully with the prevention program, we can keep them from ever coming here. They are in isolated instances in the state to the south and isolated in the state to the west. The land of 10,000 lakes has them isolated in some lakes, and they have been successful so far in keeping them from spreading. So that would be our hope, is that we would keep them from spreading. Now, how do they spread? They attach to things, and there's some concern that no matter what we do, somebody's going to have one on their wader, someone's going to have one, even in the eyelet of their boot, who knows where. That's true. We can't say that that's not true. However, that does not seem to be the predominant way that they spread. One area of concern is felt soles on fishing boots, and those are being phased out in a lot of places because they are a fertile place for these things to attach. But the primary, by far the most pervasive way that these things travel from place to place is being attached to boats or being in the cooling systems of boats or the water lockers. And in fact, they originally came here from Europe in the ballast in large ships. So boats are, you see them on the highway all the time. In fact, I remember one time we were out on the Red Desert riding horseback, and we thought, watching everything go by, and we thought, you know, if we could set up some kind of a brokerage agency and broker the boats on the West Coast to the West Coast guys and the ones on the East Coast to the East Coast guys, and we could rake in all the money that's being spent hauling them back and forth, we'd be rich. So that is the primary form of transportation, and that is what this bill is primarily directed at, a boat inspection program, a decontamination program, some authority for peace officers to detain boats if that becomes necessary, and funding for that from boaters to the extent that Game and Fish thinks it's feasible. So, with that, looking at the bill, there are some definitions on page 2 that includes the conveyances and decontamination and that sort of thing. Starting on page 3, there's a section that's all about the prohibitions about aquatic invasive species and basically makes it a high misdemeanor to introduce them and contains certain prohibitions that basically make it against the law and a civil penalty to introduce aquatic invasive species anywhere in the state. Then starting on page 4, there are enforcement paragraphs. And in committee, with the standing committee amendment, we did add the Department of State Parks and Cultural Resources to the bill. Their role almost exclusively will be selling permits to boat owners. And one of the questions I got was, well, you're going to spend, we asked for $1.1 million, it got cut to $500,000. You're going to spend $500,000 maybe to collect $750,000, which doesn't seem like a very good investment. But the sale of those permits will involve an educational component, which is really what this has to come down to. We cannot monitor every point of entry in the state. We can't monitor every boat ramp. We can't monitor every launching place that someone might put something in the water that's been someplace else where there are these species. So education is important. We've had limited success with education already. We did have a very large boat that came into the large lake down in southern Sweetwater County, and it was purchased in an easterly location. And that boat owner had been educated about mussels, and thankfully, just for us, I saw a picture. It's a huge boat. I think they had to use a crane to offload it. And the boat owner said just before they offloaded it, he told the mechanic, why don't you go through here and make sure there aren't any mussels on this boat? And there were. And they caught them. And it wasn't because we had people there inspecting. It was because we'd made the boat owner aware of that danger, and he took the responsibility himself to be sure that the boat was inspected before it went in the water. So that is a big part of it. The enforcement thing, I hope, it does not become a big issue, but it does contain authority for peace officers to stop conveyances, to inspect them and detain them and have them decontaminated if it can't be accomplished on a voluntary basis. It then contains a section that gives rulemaking authority to the Game and Fish Commission and State Parks and Cultural Resources. We discussed that carefully with them in committee, the two department heads, and how that rulemaking would work. Game and Fish has some previous experience in rulemaking that involved cooperation with another agency. Both department heads told us that it was doable, that they could write rules that would dovetail in together with each other. So we wanted to involve state parks because they have entry points for a lot of our waterways or our bodies of water in the state. Then there's a section that allows the collection of fees. There's a section on page 9 that sets up a separate account within the Game and Fish so that it works kind of like an enterprise fund. The fees go in there and are continuously appropriated for administration of the Act. And then there is the appropriation, as I said, $2.5 million for Game and Fish for the biennium. And after the Standing Committee Amendment number 2 comes on, $500,000 for state parks and cultural resources for 1 year. Now, there are a lot of concerns about this. The overriding concern is we just can't allow these things to get in our water if we can find a way to prevent it. There already are long lines of boats. For instance, on the 4th of July, to get into Glendale, there's all kinds of long lines. The lines are going to be longer. We're going to do what we can to help that. One of the things we can do is have state parks and cultural resources do the educational component, sell the stickers to the boat owners, and spend all that time. That leaves the Game and Fish people not tying up their time selling stickers, but instead doing boat inspections and making sure. And they're going to do some rulemaking. They're going to find out where the boat came from. If they know the boat owner and know the boat, that's going to be one thing. If they don't know it, if it came from an infected water or it's suspected, then that's going to bring another level, and that needs to be done through rulemaking. But we want our Game and Fish people to be doing that and not selling permits. There is one, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how you want to handle this. I have a standing committee amendment that needs to go in. That standing committee amendment number, or I'm sorry, committee of the whole amendment number 1, and that was an omission that was caught by LSO. That needs to go on the bill so it's clear that there's authority for an annual fee, authority for payments of the fees, and the sticker that goes on the boat, which is going to be part of the program that the Game and Fish will run. So that's about as quickly and succinctly as I can go through it. There is another standing committee amendment that has to go on, and I think I'll make my motion on the Committee of the Whole amendment after that. When we get all the amendments in, I suppose, Mr. Chairman, I would take questions at that point.
Representative Brown, do you want to move a standing committee amendment number 1?
I think the TRW chairman already moved standing committee amendment number 1.
Oh, you did.
Mr.
I'm
chairman.
Sorry. Question being called. You have heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question being called, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill, ready for standing committee amendment number 2, Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I move standing committee amendment number 2 to House Bill 18. And this addresses some of the issues that the good representative from Albany County brought up. And that has to do with the necessity of a position as a coordinator for this project. And so, as we've talked earlier in the week about taking care of some vacancies that have occurred in the agencies as we've gone through working the budget, this is one of those positions with the Game and Fish. So basically, if you look at this amendment, at the bottom in Section 4, it explains the position that we are using in order to utilize for a coordinator of this project. So that takes care of page 1, section or line 6 for the vacant position. The second component is based on reduction to the parks and cultural resources of the funds requested for the first year of operations. And then the third piece to this amendment is in regard to coming back on an exception, so exception budget, rather than having these amounts rolled into a standard budget. So our discussion in JAC is that this is a new program. We would like to have statistics and a review of the project and what the needs are or how successful it is in order to justify the funding. Also, what was testified to us is that they don't know the figures yet as to what it will take in order to deal with this invasive species. And then the other component has to do with the 4-1 on non-residential licensing for helping to sustain this project. So that is the amendment, and I ask for your favorable consideration.
You've heard the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to divide that amendment, and I would propose that lines 5 through 11 be Division 1 and the rest of the bill be Division 2.
Heard the motion on Standing Committee Amendment number 2. The division number 1 is between 10 and 11, so that would be Division 1. Division 2 would be 11 through 42. We are on Division 1. Any further discussion on Division 1?
Mr. Chairman, that's not quite right. I'd like lines 5 through 11.
5 through 11.
To be Division 1. Division 2 then would be lines 1 through 4 and 12 through 42.
Okay. Discussion on Division 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
This is a provision that was inserted by the Appropriations Committee and would require that fees for stickers on boats be at a 4-to-1 ratio, that stickers on out-of-state boats be, and I don't know if it said exactly, yes, it's exactly, that the fees on non-residents for inspections is 4 times the fee imposed on residents. The Game and Fish testimony that we heard in committee said that in the state to the northwest of us, it's 10 and 20. In the state south of us, it's 10 and 20. It seems like the out-of-state fee is typically about twice the in-state fee. The question was asked in appropriations, what is the customary ratio for such things as out-of-state hunting licenses and things like that? And the Game and Fish said, well, the rule of thumb, although it's awful rough, is 5-to-1. And so this got put in at 4-to-1. But it is, we know that it's out of step with neighboring states, and I just don't think it belongs in the bill. I would rather see the Game and Fish have the discretion through their rulemaking authority to set the fees and the ratio between non-resident and resident at what they think they can logically charge, given all the facts and circumstances, including neighboring states. So I would urge you to defeat Division 1 of the Standing Committee Amendment number 2.
Further discussion on Division 1? Question being called?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Z Harsh wants to talk. I'm last on the alphabet, so Zitter Harsh.
Representative Harshman.
Is Mr. Stewart?
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little background. Try to put this into perspective, just so you know, what we did in what we'll be calling Division 2, starting on page line 19 on their Standing Committee Amendment, we basically turned this appropriation into a one-time funding, okay? And going back to now your bill that's in front of you on page 8, lines 11 through 15, what that language will tell you is that this program is supposed to be self-sustaining, meaning the fees from selling of these stickers for the boats is supposed to carry the water for this program. With that foundation of knowledge and knowing that perhaps we really don't have enough boaters in our state to really generate enough income, we looked at, in a rational manner,
a way that we could sustain this program long term, like it was proposed to us, that we're going to be in it for a nickel and a dime, that we did have to raise substantial dollars to fund this program long term, and also comport with language already adopted through committee, that the intention, of course, is for fees to carry this program. So this was, I would say, well thought out, and I would maintain probably not onerous to our neighboring states.
Representative Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other discussion that we had was pertaining to, should you treat this issue the way that we treat brucellosis? And that is that you have states that have brucellosis have more steps to getting into our state. And what we've said is, okay, so our surrounding states, minus one, if you look at the map up to the left, I don't know how you describe stuff without saying names, all have this in their states. And so those are the people who are going to be coming in to vote. And there's a cost associated with keeping this out of our state. And the real cost is that you get in places like where, in testimony where in the state of the Golden Bear, so trying to be creative here, are spending $90 million a year as a cleanup problem. What we're trying to do is prevent it from coming in here, and there's a cost associated with that. And we felt that the people who will be bringing it in are most likely it's not going to be coming from intrastate, it's coming from out of state. And therefore, we deferred the cost through our discussion in that same manner. There's going to be a cost increase to everybody, and it should probably be paid for by the people who are more likely to be bringing it in than the people who were already here. And that was the discussion we had pertaining to the 4-to-1 fee level on this.
Privilege of the floor, Representative Millen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Speaker, for allowing that. I hate to do this at this time, but this group came after we started the bill, and they need to leave before we get done. So today, for Wyoming Educational Access Day, students and staff of the Wyoming TRIO and Gear Up programs are here today to bring awareness of educational access issues. TRIO and Gear Up are federally funded projects that provide assistance and support the first-generation college students, students with limited income, students traditionally underrepresented in higher education, and students with disabilities to aspire them to gain admissions to and succeed in higher education. Each year, the 11 Wyoming TRIO programs and 2 Wyoming Gear Up programs serve over 6,000 students. Here today representing us from Casper, Cheyenne, and Laramie are students from the Student Support Services, Upward Bound, Math Science Initiative, McNair Educational Opportunity Center, and Gear Up. These students also provided you to the goodie bags that you found on your desk this morning. And they've been in the breezeway. If you want to visit their booth in the Herschler breezeway, please welcome them to the house.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you. While we're taking a breather, we have another class from Kelly Walsh down here in the gallery today. It's a ninth grade social studies class with Mrs. Rose DiNino, and they are in the South Gallery. If you'd please welcome them.
Representative Brown, privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, also present in the north balcony is the UW Pre-Law Club, and their Professor Cheryl Burnett. Would you all step, please, or stand up?
Okay. Back on Division One, Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members in support of Division One, and really, if you look at the fiscal note on the original bill, was really about a 2-to-1 fee structure. Out-of-staters paying about $2 for every $1 in-state. The standard fee structure on game and fish, these type of issues, which has been kind of set through different lawsuits around the country, interstate commerce, what's kind of survived some of these tests is about a 5-to-1 ratio, whereas the out-of-state license is 5 times higher than the in-state license. So in our deliberations in the Appropriations Committee, we thought 4-to-1 would be appropriate as opposed to the 2-to-1 that was given to us in the fiscal note. And again, this is right currently now an out-of-state boater's problem. And we figured instead of a $64, $30 type fee, maybe it'd be more appropriate a $10 fee in-state and set that out-of-state fee just a little bit higher. So in support of this and I appreciate your consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I certainly understand what we're trying to do here. While Wyoming should get more from non-residents for their recreation in the state of Wyoming than our residents do, just like other states do to residents of Wyoming, please consider there is a tax theory or a tax axiom in regard to taxes, or in this case fees, that the more you charge, the more you charge, the higher the evasion will be. So keep that in mind. And I'm not sure what the fees will be yet, and none of us do, as I understand it, just that it'll be 4 times, 5 times, whatever X is. But that the higher you charge, the greater the potential for evasion, and which is exactly what we're trying to prevent.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against this Division One, speaking from an area that has worked really hard to try and reintroduce tourism, particularly boating tourism in my part of the country, I just am really concerned about the 4-to-1 ratio. And I think that particularly when we live so close to the neighboring state, and as we drive to the community that is north of us and count the boats, and that's our hobby, count the boats that are coming down to visit our lake. And I consider that out of a question of fairness, I think 4-to-1 is just a little high, and I think that it may be a deterrent to the efforts that we have made in encouraging water recreation up in the national recreation area. So I would urge caution, and I'm a no vote on this part of the amendment.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let's think about that for a minute. I think your perspective might be a little different depending on whether you live in around the fringes of the state or whether you live right in the middle of the state. I think those around the fringe might be more sensitive to how that will affect out-of-state boaters. Those who live in the interior of the state may not be so worried about it. But consider this. We've determined, short of an owner's fee, $34 for an in-state and $64 for an out-of-state would come close to making this program break even. That's just, people tell us that is too much. So if it's too much, and if the fee has to be something lower than that, then understand that there's going to be some general fund dollars going to this program. And remember, this program is to try to prevent them from being here at all. And if it falls short of that, keep them out of here as long as we can, because once they're here, it's going to cost us more money than it costs us to try to keep them out. And so understand that make this whole thing right on the back of out-of-state boaters. And maybe we'd get it, maybe we'd get it done, and maybe we wouldn't. But if the aquatic invasive species ever establish themselves in the state, then it's not going to be the out-of-state boaters that carry the huge burden from there on. It's going to be this general fund, and it's going to be our people in our state, our residents and our users. And so I agree with the comment that was made. The higher the fee, the more evasion there's going to be. I think the Game and Fish has the best knowledge and the best intelligence about what the correct fee ought to be for out-of-state and in-state. I think they'll know more in a year if somebody's unhappy with their rulemaking and the fees that they institute. In a year, we're going to be able to address those again. I just think to start out with a 4-to-1 for all those reasons is not the right thing to do to mandate it in statute. And I would ask you to defeat Division One and leave the amount of the fees and the ratio of the fees to the Game and Fish to do through rulemaking.
Question, Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I just, I guess I'm more concerned about our in-state boaters, and I think having a 2-to-1 proposal is something that is not done elsewhere. All the other states, including our state, charge more of a 4-to-1, 5-to-1 ratio, and, I think a $10 fee for in-state folks, 40 out of state, 20, whatever it might be, is not going to be evasive. I think by making sure we have this 4-to-1 ratio, I think it will avoid the in-state evasive part instead of the proposed $30 fee or whatever it was in the fiscal note. So, I'm thinking about our in-state folks. The out-of-state folks who are cruising up there with their big pickups and their big boats, I don't think it matters what the fee is. But we know that we're within the guidelines of what's acceptable and what's been challenged. The 5-to-1 ratio and 4-to-1 seems to fit well within there. So I urge your support for the first division and also support of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question being called. We are on.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I just have to answer that. And if anybody on the committee heard something different than I heard, then speak up. Now is the time. I don't think that's a correct representation. The question was, what is the differential run, taking into account everything, taking into account, for instance, mountain sheep, goats, those kind of things? What is the ratio run? And the answer that we got was very rough, maybe in some instances 5-to-1. It didn't say that everything was 5-to-1, and the testimony before our committee was that boat fees in adjoining states are in the order of 2-to-1. And that's why I'm having so much trouble with this division, and I would ask you to defeat it.
Any further discussion on division? Question being called. We are on House Bill 18, Standing Committee 2, Division 1. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Division 1 passed. Division's been called. All in favor of Division 1, please stand. All opposed, please stand. Division 1 has failed. We are now on Division 2. Representative Brown. I'm sorry, Representative Berger. No, nothing else?
Mr. Chairman, we just call for the question on the second division.
Okay. Question's been called on Division 2. All in favor of Division 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Division 2 is passed. At Committee of the Whole Amendment, Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Zeharsh has been messing with my papers here. And Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 and urge its favorable adoption. This would add a section in the bill that was inadvertently omitted, and and makes it clear that there's authority to collect an annual fee and put a sticker on the watercraft and defines watercraft. I had urged your favorable vote on that amendment.
Question being called on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. I'm sorry, Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question. The good vice chairman of a corporation says it defines watercraft, and I'm going to ask him whether that also includes, and I don't see the definition, but does that include canoes?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, the Committee of the Whole Amendment, the last sentence says, for purposes of this paragraph, watercraft means any contrivance used or designed primarily for navigation on water, but does not include personal flotation devices. I call for the question, Mr. Chairman.
Question being called. All in favor of the motion of House Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 passes. We are now back on the bill. Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just can't imagine that this body is going to pass this thing out with just a little bit of conversation, and I do have some real concerns about it. I understand that there are problems, and I actually took a tour of the lower Colorado River in January, so I've seen the quagga mussel firsthand. But this is an expansion of government. We just need to all be aware of that. We're going to add 29 positions, 12 trucks, 9 demonstration units, decontamination units, and the list goes on and on. I know we're getting tired of the debate. But I think we ought to know what we're doing before we do it. And it does have implications on the rights of people, and we ought to talk about it. I appreciate the conversation that the good vice chairman brought up and the fact that if we do get this mussel, that it will cost more to deal with it after it's here than this method of prevention. But I still have some concern that it's like the bark beetle, that there's not a whole lot we're going to do about it. So I needed to air my piece and say that, and I would appreciate some further discussion.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps it would be helpful to read a list of waters where we're going to have watercraft inspection stations, just for a start. This isn't everything in the state, but this is a start that perhaps helps us understand just how formidable this task is. Cody. Bighorn Lake, Buffalo Bill Reservoir. Sheridan, Lake DeSmit, Keyhole Reservoir. Jackson, Jackson Lake, Palisades Reservoir. Pinedale, Fremont Lake. Lander, Ocean Lake and Boyson Reservoir. Casper, Seminole Reservoir, Pathfinder Reservoir, Alcova Reservoir, Glendale Reservoir, Guernsey Reservoir. Green River, Sulphur Creek Reservoir, Viva Naughton Reservoir, Fontenelle Reservoir, Flaming Gorge Reservoir, Big Sandy Reservoir. Laramie, Wheatland Number 1 Reservoir, Granite Reservoir, Gray Rocks Reservoir, and Hawk Springs Reservoir. Now, that's quite a list of bodies of water, and it doesn't cover them all. Those are the places where we're going to try to cover them on a continuous basis with extended hours. And when we're talking about boats, it's not just the summer season. It's from about the 1st of April until sometime into October. And we need to have at least 2 people there. We need to be able to sell permits when it's time to sell permits, and we need to be able to inspect those boats on a continuing basis. And I admit, it's going to take a lot of people and a lot of equipment. Besides the people and the pickups, we need the decontamination stations. And it's a tough deal, and I'd be the first to admit it. But the only thing I can say is there's no going back. If these things get in the state, there's no remediation, and it is very difficult to deal with. So deal with it is what we're trying to do.
Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple of questions. This bill is needed. I just have a lot of stuff I think is wrong with it as a boater. One of the things I'd like to ask the bringer of the bill, and I guess that came out of a committee, is where it says on page 5, require the owner of the conveyance to decontaminate the conveyance or And then we go into where the new dock police that we're hiring are going to possibly impound my boat, even though it's never been out of the state of Wyoming. We don't have the muscle in Wyoming yet. Who's going to pay for that decontamination? I see we've, in the fiscal note, we've hired a bunch of people are going to with decontamination equipment, but it isn't clear if they're going to impound my boat because they suspect I have a quagga mussel in my sea strainer. And I'll wait for the answer on that one.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, we're talking about page 5, lines 9 through 19. And that says, every conveyance shall stop at an authorized mandatory aquatic invasive species check station in accordance with the rules established by the commission and with the amendment and state parks and cultural resources. Upon probable cause that an aquatic invasive species may be present, a peace officer may either require the owner of the conveyance to decontaminate or decontaminate and impound and quarantine the conveyance. Now, it says everybody has to stop. It says if there's probable cause, a peace officer can do this. Well, what's probable cause? I always thought in law school it meant more likely than not. And there's got to be some rational basis. There has to be more than just a suspicion. It has to be based on some fact. Probable cause is something we use with respect to when a police officer can stop someone for DUI, for instance. And he's got to have some rational basis for it. It's a well-established phrase in the law. It doesn't make it arbitrary. He can't just do it just because he's having a bad day and he decides he's going to stop this guy. There's got to be some probable cause. They're required to stop. What would be probable cause? Where has this boat come from? Well, it came from this lake in Colorado. He looks on his list and it says this lake in Colorado is infected. That's probable cause to look at the boat and determine whether it's been cleansed of quagga mussels or whether there are some on there, and if there are some on there, to detain that boat and decontaminate it. And if the owner won't do it voluntarily, then the peace officer would decontaminate it before the boat could leave. I don't know how else you would run this. And it's not arbitrary. It's not just on a whim. It's on some reasonable suspicion that there is a possibility of a mussel being there. Where's this boat been? I refuse to tell you. That's probable cause. As soon as the guy says, I refuse to tell you, any peace officer would say, well, I'm going to take the cautious route. Where's the boat been? It's been in the, we're at Seminole and it's been in Pathfinder. No probable cause, no reason to think there's one there. Neither one's an infected water. He lets it go. So that is the basis, Mr. Chairman, upon which those kind of decisions would be made.
Representative Gilmore, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I question then for basically $16 per boater, in-state boater, we need to do something worse to keep the greenies out. But $16 won't get my boat decontaminated. It would cost me a lot of money to get. I happen to have a pretty nice boat. So with a flushing toilet, sea strainers, and I know that my $16 permit won't get that decontaminated, even though I'm an honest guy and I don't want these mussels to get in our water at all. What concerns me is, if we're willing to invest this $2.5 million into buying decontamination equipment, why wouldn't my permit? Why couldn't it just be decontaminated there by the boat ramp guy? Why are we buying the equipment, I guess, is my answer, if I still have to, on my own, get it decontaminated?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, the most effective way of decontaminating these boats is to use a high-pressure washer with boiling hot water in it. People aren't, I dare say the questioner isn't going to have one of those handy. So we're going to have portable decontamination units. We're going to do the decontamination. You spend your money for a permit. The permit allows you to put your boat in the waters of the state of Wyoming and allows us to collect some revenue to offset the cost of the program and allows the state an opportunity to educate you about invasive aquatic species. If you then come to an area and a peace officer finds probable cause to say that your boat is contaminated, the state's going to decontaminate the boat. You're not going to get the bill for the decontamination. You paid into the program when you got your sticker fee, and hopefully, because decontamination does not represent a large cost to you or a penalty, you won't have any reservation about having the boat inspected, knowing that if it's inspected and something is found, the state will decontaminate your boat, and you have insured yourself for that by buying the permit.
Thank you.
Madam Majority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions on the bill. I would like a definition of, on page 3, what we mean by waters of this state. I want to know if that includes all the rivers, the streams, private reservoirs, launch any conveyance into the waters of this state. And then I'd like some further explanation also on page 5, that the commission may restrict watercraft usage. Now, that's watercraft is a term I haven't seen identified. Does that mean conveyance? Should that be conveyance rather than watercraft? So if I could have a discussion about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what to say about waters of this state, except that, again, I think is a commonly used term. I think we use it in water law a lot to talk about waters of this state. And, in fact, I think the Constitution has those very words in it. I think it says all waters of this state are the property of the state. That's a rough recall of the Constitution. So it seems to me to be a self-explanatory term. The watercraft is not, I have to admit, is not a defined term, and if that is, I think we're talking about line 21 on page 5. The commission, in consultation with special parks and state parks and cultural resources, may restrict watercraft usage on waters of the state. I'd just like to hold a marker there because I think watercraft might be defined somewhere else, and if it's not, we'd certainly be amenable to an amendment that would define watercraft.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate my good neighbor from District 14 providing that list of the water bodies that are going to be targeted. I forgot my map, and of course that list was, I think, 100% Federal Bureau projects. So I guess my question goes along the lines of where in this legislation do we recognize this partner, and where in this bill do we try and also recognize a duty for them to live up to perhaps some obligations that we may see here, to where we might not misconstrue our efforts that would somehow allow them some benefits that clearly we would rather have them step up to the plate perhaps with their checkbook as well.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that is there's a lot about this we don't know. We feel a great urgency to get started because these aquatic invasive species are on the move. And I don't think we're going to do a perfect job the first year. I think we're going to make mistakes. My hope is that those mistakes won't result in some of our waters of the state getting infected. I think a year from now we'll know a lot more, and there are a number of parties who are involved in this. But you know what, ladies and gentlemen, it's kind of like education. When it comes down to the end, the buck stops here right in this chamber. It's here in the bottom line, and we're going to get the cost one way or the other. We may get it from cities and towns because their intake structures are clogged and they need more funds in order to administer their program. Who knows where it's coming from? But in the end, it all comes and settles in right here. So I'm not, that's an allocation problem. And who should we allocate those costs to? Which department? But in the end, we fund all the departments. So we'll know a lot more next year, and maybe we'll do some things with it.
Representative Lubnow.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm glad that we got through the amendments so that we could get to the bill. I have a few questions on it. In the middle of page 4, lines 11 through 14, it says, a person who knows that an aquatic invasive species is present at a specific location shall immediately report that knowledge and all pertinent information to the commissioner or a peace officer. I would hope that you distribute maps to all the citizens of Wyoming, because it doesn't say a specific location in Wyoming. It just says a specific location anywhere, and that's a high misdemeanor in Wyoming. Perhaps we should fine-tune that language. The next question I have is, it's the 3rd of July. You're going out with your family, and you go into the lake, and you pull up to the lake, the game warden or the peace officer, whoever, says, I'm impounding your boat. Well, for how long? Well, for a reasonable time, I guess is what it says in the middle of or bottom of page 7. An impoundment or conveyance may continue for a reasonable period necessary to inspect and decontaminate the conveyance and to ensure that the aquatic invasive species has been completely eradicated from the conveyance or is no longer living. So that either means cleaned or just sits out there till the thing dies. And so does this bill contemplate limits on the state of Wyoming on how long they can keep my boat for the 4th of July weekend? And then the last question I have is on page 9. It says that the commission can bring a civil action for civil damages against somebody. And I'm wondering, are those civil damages unlimited? Are they their entire costs of remediating mussels if they find a mussel on the bottom of my boat? What's contemplated there? And what are the limits on the powers of the state that are contemplated by the committee? And, I mean, I understand the need for the bill. I just don't want the bill to be drafted so that it can work mischief, and I want to make sure that we can craft some amendments if there are limits that are contemplated.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, the questioner knows perhaps better than I do what a reasonable time is. And it varies with the facts and circumstances, and I don't know what else you can do. What are we going to, are we going to self-punish ourselves? Are we going to self-inflict and say, we've got 3 hours to hold the boat, and then you got to let it go in the water, potentially infected with mussels? I don't know. We have to hold it a reasonable time. We have to do the best job we can. If somebody has to give, they have to give, unless you just want to roll the dice on whether it's an infected boat or not. With respect to the other question, that begins at line 1 on page 9. It says, in addition to any other criminal penalty provided in this section, any person who violates any provision of this article may be assessed civil penalties in an amount not to exceed the costs incurred by the commission and State Parks and Recreation in enforcing the provisions of this article. So that's the sideboards on the cost. If you want to say we have to take all the costs involved in enforcing the provisions of this article and divide it by the number of boats across the state line on July the 4th, I guess you can do that. But I think that that's the sideboards on it, as far as the maximum amount that can be assessed. And I think that we all understand that's not going to be invoked unless there's some kind of egregious violation and probably a repeat violator, and that's when it's probably going to be invoked, just simply because until then you're not going to get the attention of anybody sufficient to bring an action.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
When the good representative from House District 5 got up and started this stimulating conversation once we got rid of the amendments, the more I listened to the debate, I started to wonder, what is it that says that we, the state of Wyoming, has to buy all this equipment and pressure washers and all these other things? What we should do is set up an inspection station and inspect the boat and put people on notice that if that is there, that doesn't go in the lake. And private enterprise can then make some money in the nearby towns, or if they want to have some of the larger reservoirs, set up a station where they can do that. And they could provide those services. But we just say, you can't put a boat in our water as long as our inspection shows it's got mussels or in any species on it. I kind of think that's a better idea than us getting into the business of high-pressure washers and all of these other types of things, plus the maintenance that those things take.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm struggling with this annual fee concept that's in the Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1. If you go to page 8, line 4 says the Commission may establish and collect fees in accordance with the following. And then we're adding a new Romanet subparagraph 1 that says an annual fee shall be collected, but line 4 says they may establish it. So I'm not sure whether they should or they have to. Once they collect the annual fee, what does the annual fee certify? What does the sticker certify? Is it that you've been inspected or you just bought the annual fee? Or you bought the permit? So if you bought the permit, there's no certification that your aquatic invasive species free, and you go down to the water with your permit and you're asked to be inspected. And on page 7, under subparagraph F at the top, a peace officer may impound and quarantine a conveyance if, Romanet 1, they find an invasive species after conducting an inspection. And then Romanets 2 and 3, Romanet 2 is bothersome in that there's no required finding that there is an aquatic species, invasive species, or even a probable cause. They can just take your boat if you refuse to have it inspected. And I can imagine people driving up and thinking, well, I only had an hour and I'm leaving because the line is this long. And there ought to be some type of belief that there's a reason you should be inspected. And then with number 3, the person transporting refuses to comply with an order to decontaminate. And then when you look at the order is only issued if the aquatic invasive species is present. So I'm okay with that. But F2 on page 7 bothers me. To echo the comments of the good representative from Campbell County, those penalties are so broad and kind of vague that we could sue one person who thought there was an aquatic species for all the damage we could muster. That's not the idea of it. I certainly understand the problem, and I will vote for this on Committee of the Whole, but let's try and tighten this thing up and make it a better bill.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that might be, think about this the same way as the state's underground storage tank program. In the state's underground storage tank program, we recognize the fact that one of those federal mandates that we might refuse to enforce, but we're doing it right now, says if there's a leaking underground storage tank and it contaminates the soil, that can even become a Superfund site. And Superfund sites, most of the federal government's Superfund money is not spent cleaning these up. Most of it's spent suing people who created the problem and recovering damages from them for cleaning it up. So how does the underground storage tank system work? If you have underground storage tanks, you pay into the program every year. And I think it's $100. It used to be $100. It's kind of like insurance. Every underground storage tank pays it in, and it doesn't get a sticker put on it, but it gets a certification that it's a participant in the underground storage tank program. If there's a leak from that tank and it precipitates a Superfund site, the state cleans it up out of that fund. And to the extent that that fund falls short, the state pays the bill. This is sort of the same way. We're going to sell boaters a sticker. If you have a sticker, you're in the program. You've been educated about what the mussels are, and you're good to be in the waters of the state of Wyoming, subject to having your boat inspected, and if mussels are found, decontaminated by the state. That's the way the program's trying to work, and it's trying to keep the waters of the state safe.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I decided I better come up here and help defend my fellow committee man, carrying all the weight for our committee. But I have just a few answers to some of the questions that have been raised, and there's definitely some more work that we need to do on this, and we will. To address the good chairman of education's committee about private enterprise, we did talk a lot about that. The problem is there's too many places to put in boats. If I am an inspector and I stop someone and I say, you need to clean up your boat, and if I as the inspector do not do it right there, he's going to say, yeah, I'll do it, I'll take care of it. And he's going to go to a different boat place and put it in the water because he doesn't care. He doesn't have to deal with it. There are hundreds and hundreds of places to put in boats that are prepared and that we can put inspection places, let alone the places that you can just drive up and put your boats in. So it's really a tough situation. We talked about that at length, and that's something we would have loved to do, but we just don't see how it's feasible at this point. And again, the good speaker was asking about the sticker, and it's not a certification. It's just a fee. It's just like the license plate on your vehicle. It doesn't certify anything. It's just a fee to help pay for this program. So I appreciate all the input. I appreciate the questions. I've got lots of notes and flags, and we will continue to tighten this up. Thank you.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to address a question posed by the good representative from Thermopolis concerning what a watercraft is. And that actually is on the Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, where it says it means a contrivance used or designated primarily for navigation on water. That same definition is found in Title 41, Chapter 13, watercraft. I notice that it does not include personal flotation devices on the Committee of the Whole Amendment. So that brings me to kind of a question and consideration, because I don't know that much about the mussel. I am convinced that it's a threat to wildlife and to our fisheries and to the infrastructure. So that I think we need to take that as seriously as a threat, and because it could affect all kinds of things, water birds, you name it. So what do we do, and how do we have some restrictions that really get to the problem of it? I like the ideas proposed by the good representative from Lander, where you have a private inspection type of thing. And what if somebody comes into the state to go boating on one of our big lakes in the southwest part of the state and comes for maybe 4 or 5 days
and then goes back home into a more southern state and comes back a month or two later. It seems like they should go through a process of being licensed again and inspected and cleaned up. Whereas the person who lives there, who has a canoe and who takes that out, does that have the same threat and comes back and dries it out and so on? You know, some of these watercrafts have live wells and they have water systems to cool off the motors and all of that. And so you can see where the mussels could hide on those. And other watercraft are just basically a hull and are self-propelled or like these personal flotation devices. So I think that there's really a lot of fine issues, I should say, and things that need thought in here on how to really set up a system that's going to prevent this to get into our water. And so I just thought I'd ask to a little more information about the mussel as far as basically a canoe-type vehicle and how much of a threat that is compared to a motorboat with intake and exhaust of water.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to go back to the question posed by the representative from House District 54, and let's start forward from there. The extreme, and I have said this, it's not practical, but the extreme is, and the cheapest, really, the cheapest way to put a stop to all this is prevent boating in the state. If we say no boating, we've probably got the problem handled. And as far as personal flotation devices, we can say no personal flotation devices. We can say no fishing. That's an extreme that only serves to prove a point. On the other extreme, we just leave the state wide open, and when the mussels get here, they get here, and we deal with them then. We're trying to hit a balance somewhere in the middle. We're taking the highest exposure, and the experts tell us that the highest exposure and the thing that breached the 100th Meridian Initiative was boats. So we're looking at boats. It is true that these things may adhere to waders or personal flotation devices. We're going to try to educate the public. I think the probability is smaller that the things will get loose that way. For one thing, I think a lot of waders and personal flotation devices are out of the water for a significant period of time between one place and another. That may be enough to kill them. But we're simply starting with boats because that's where the experts tell us the greatest probabilities are. Now, with respect to the canoe versus the big boat, it is true that somewhere up the spectrum from saying no boating at all, we could start differentiating between the sizes of boats. But let's keep in mind what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is create a program where people do not have an incentive to avoid inspection and avoid decontamination, that they welcome it. They know if they bought that sticker, that's the extent of their exposure, and they'll cooperate with us. Because if they don't cooperate, I think YDOT came in our, we talked about at one point, well, let's just seal the borders of the state. Well, YDOT came in and said there are 64 entry points into the state. Actually, I know where there's a dirt road down on the south end of the state that's used frequently that I know is not in their count. So there's at least 65. Well, we're talking here about 30 lakes that we're trying to look at. We can't go to 65 or 64 points of entry in the state and police it that way. We just can't. Furthermore, if we get an infected body of water somewhere in the state, we need to have, hopefully by then, if it ever happens, we have a mechanism in place that will lend itself immediately toward an isolation of the species in that particular lake and or body of water and won't let it spread everywhere. So those are some of the reasons. We can do a lot of things and do it in terms of user fees and heap fees on, but as the
Representative from House District 35 said, as the price goes up, the penalty goes up, the evasion goes up. We don't want evasion. We want people to cooperate with this program. And if they have doubt, we want them to self-police and come to one of our people and say, hey, I'm bringing this boat in. I've been someplace. Would you inspect the boat? And if I've got a problem here, would you decontaminate it? Because the beneficiary of that is us, not them.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we discussed this in TRW, we just came up with just about everything you're saying, but put yourself in our place. We were trying to come up with a bill that we could avoid the best we could, and I think there's some good points being brought up that we can do better. We can make the bill better. But one of the main points that we're bringing up, if we don't have cooperation from the general public, both in-state and out-of-state, and I think the out-of-state people need that education, and they're probably ahead of us in that education. But just like the example that was given in the big lake down by me, the guy just brought his boat in and said, you know, I really think we ought to have a look at this because I'm concerned. Well, somebody had educated him, and that's what we'd like to do with everybody. So I think the key to this whole thing is education. And I think the Game and Fish have been putting out all kinds of information and trying to get us to educate, you know, our communities about this. So education, I think, is the biggest thing that we have going to help. And each one of these points that you're bringing up, we surely need to look at and see if we can make the bill better. But we're just faced with a tough, tough thing, and I think all the suggestions are good, and we'll keep looking at them. A specific answer to what does that permit give you? When you buy a permit and put it on your boat, and then they look at the boat, then you put it in the water, you go home, you're in state, you come back, and all they have to say, has this boat been out of the state? No, it hasn't. So they don't even need to inspect it again. So the sticker just saves you a bunch of hassle each time. Once you buy the sticker and it's inspected, as you come back, where has this boat been? Well, it hasn't been anywhere that you need to be concerned about, so you're ready. So it's a smooth process for the in-state folks, and the out-of-state folks, I think they're just going to be faced with more inspections. And that's some of the things that we talked about. So we're really trying to address the points you're bringing up. But as good representative said, we can throw our hands in the air and do nothing, or we can come up with a bill, have your support, your help. And again, I think education is the biggest thing we can do to help people help keep these things out. And that's probably the biggest push we have. But then we need to do all these other things in between. So thank you.
Chairman Childers, did you have any comment? Representative Gilmore.
Actually, this will sound crazy. As bad as I hate this bill, I know it's necessary, and I'll probably vote for it. It needs some tweaking. One of the things that I can shed a little light on, what I have been told, is that if your boat is out of the water for 10 days, those quagga mussels are dead if they're not floating in water. So that issue of them being stuck to the trailer, if you can say, well, I haven't had it out for 2 weeks, they're pretty sure they're gone. I guess I would like the members of TRW to be at Pathfinder this late May, when I'm on that ramp and there's about 50 other boaters already unhappy just because I'm in their way, and some boat dock guy that we've just hired is inspecting my boat. And I hope we pass the packing without a permit law, because I'll tell you what, there's going to be the most unbelievable amount of fights on those ramps, and it needs to be done where you can voluntarily take your boat to the game and fish office in your town and say, can you check this, and throw a sticker on there. I think it's easier there than buying the sticker at the ramp. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can go to the game and fish office ahead of time and buy the sticker. But at least you've got to have somebody at the ramp that at least says, how long has this boat been out of the water? Where was it the last time? Okay, you're good. In the water you go. If he doesn't get satisfactory answers to those questions, the boat's got to be pulled out of the line. I don't know how else to do it, unless you want to revert to the default, which is stop boating. And, Mr. Chairman, just one last observation for the benefit of the speaker. I'm informed that I didn't cover some of the finer points of the underground storage tank program, but I kind of got the drift of it. I'm not too far off.
Question being called. All of those in favor of Chairman Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation of due pass, Bill Number 18. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 18 passes the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 67. Would the reading clerk read the bill?
House Bill 67, introduced by Representative Yellaway, an act relating to taxation and revenue. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stepson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 67 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I turn the explanation of the bill over to my roommate from Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Chairman Illoway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I'm going to ask if we could just have it a little bit quiet over here so we can do a bill. Thank you. We're going to talk about House Bill 67, which is data centers. Data centers, the definition, if you don't know what a data center is found on the second page of the bill. I'm not going to read it. Data centers have been actively recruited for a number of years. They've been recruited by the Business Council. They've been recruited by the economic development organizations in the state. Why? Because they do pay taxes. They pay a lot of property taxes, and they pay a lot of sales tax. The reason they pay a lot of property tax is because the buildings that they build to house the data center are generally large and generally very expensive because of the HVACs and other items that are in there. Why do they pay sales tax, large sales tax? Because they use a lot of electricity. And they pay large amounts of tax on the the amount of electricity load. It's an extremely competitive industry. Right now, and I was told recently that Wyoming and Texas are vying for a particular data center. Don't know which one it is. Don't know anything about it, except my understanding is that Wyoming and Texas are in competition. Data centers have good salaries. They're generally close to universities with their incubators. Some people will say, well, why are you giving them a sales tax exemption on certain items? You know, if we don't have them here paying property taxes, sales taxes, buying houses, and growing the economy, we're not going to reap those benefits. So I want to talk to you about the tax exemption and just walk through the bill and tell you about the exemption and the Standing Committee Amendment, and there is a Committee of the Whole Amendment. We've been working with the good chairman of the committee across, down the hall on the west side of the building. We've been working with, and this bill is a compilation from the office in the on the first floor and other offices throughout the state. On page 2, we talk about what a data processing center is, a data processing service center. On page 3, we look at the sales price paid for the purchase or rental of computer equipment, including computers, servers, monitors, keyboards, and so forth, when the aggregate purchase of the qualifying equipment exceeds $2 million in any calendar year, they are tax exempt. For the purpose of claiming this exemption, and understand it's only the exemption on the sales price or rental of the computer equipment, not the building, not the electrical use, only the computer equipment, the purchaser shall demonstrate to the department that they have a physical location in the state where the exempt equipment purchase shall be maintained and operated until the equipment is scheduled for replacement or until it has reached the end of its serviceable life. They shall make an initial capital investment in a physical location in this state of not less than $5 million, or they have made a capital investment in a physical location in this state of not less than $5 million in the last 5 years, in the 5 years immediately preceding the effective date. These folks also, they have retained adequate documentation to demonstrate that the total purchase of qualifying computer equipment exceeds the annual threshold of $2 million. Now, one of the paragraphs in the Standing Committee Amendment fits here, and it talks about, well, it's not the Standing Committee Amendment, it's the Committee of the Whole Amendment, and we'll wait on that for a minute. The qualifying business will accrue the excise tax on purchase of otherwise qualifying equipment where the annual threshold of $2 million was not met. And if they don't meet that $2 million annually, then they remit the tax to the department not later than the end of January, immediately following the end of the year. So there is the provision of you either go over $2 million on the computer equipment, you don't pay a tax, or if you're under, you are going to pay the tax. The first main part of the Standing Committee Amendment inserts on line 19, page 4, and it says that the company shall keep adequate written records and documentation in accordance with department rule and regulation to show compliance with the requirements of the subparagraph. If they don't meet it, the tax is owed back. And it follows that the Wyoming Business Council and the Department of Revenue shall jointly report to the Joint Revenue Interim Committee on or before December 1 of each year that the exemption provided by subparagraph S, that's the new part of this section, is in effect. The report shall evaluate the cumulative effects of each exemption that is in effect from initiation of the exemption, and shall include a history of employment in terms of numbers of employees, full-time and part-time employees, rates of turnover, a history of wages and benefits disaggregated by gender, and a comprehensive history of taxes paid to the state. This is found in the tax exemption statutes, 3915105, and those of us that remember, these statutes have been amended several times. One was when we talked about the new coal gasification or coal liquefaction plant. Same idea that the Business Council will review what's going on. Since this is a sales and use tax exemption, you'll notice on the bottom of page 4 it talks about exemptions 3916105. That is the use part of the proposed bill, and it goes on to page 5, and the same language fits on page 6. So that should explain the Standing Committee Amendment, so I would call a question on the Standing Committee Amendment, if I may.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Question being called. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I would like to have the good gentleman from House District 44 discuss Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, which fits back on page 4 and page 6.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the 60th. I would like to move Committee of the Whole number 1 to House Bill 67. Let me read briefly here what it adds. Page 4, after line 9, section Romanet 4, it reads as, has received annual certification from the Wyoming Business Council that the purchaser has created or will create a number of jobs in Wyoming that is appropriate to the size and stage of development of the data servicing center as determined by the Wyoming Business Council. For the sake of brevity, we have another part here that we insert on page 6. Line 9, it is the same verbiage. The reason this is inserted twice is the first insertion is relative to the statute requirement for sales tax. The second insertion is relative to the statute requirement for the use tax. And I stand for any questions.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could call for a vote on the Committee of the Whole Amendment, and then we can come back and discuss the bill and so forth.
Chairman Land, you have a question on the Committee of the Whole
Chairman, Amendment? On the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. You know, this year in particular, I got more letters and more mail concerning criticism of government intrusion into business. And this bill is full of it. And this amendment is even compounds that. And we justify what we're doing by making business do more paperwork, make more reports, make promises to us and make sure they fulfill them. And I just think if we are taking a stand here as a body to intrude into the business of business, that we can do that, but I hate to see us go down that road, so I would urge us to oppose this amendment.
Seeing no further discussion, is there a call for the question on the committee, committee of the Whole Amendment number 1? Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment number 2 is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that there are probably, I see the good gentleman from the northern part of the state. I know he wants to ask a question, so we'll stand for questions.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just go through a series of questions I have, and one that strikes me, it might appear twice in here, but it's on page 4, lines 6 through 9. Now, the way I read that, it says that if you make a purchase of $1,990 $9,999, then you would not be eligible for any of the tax exemption. But if you would spend two more dollars, so you're a dollar over $2 million, then you would get a check or an exemption of $100,000. And you know, that's kind of an all or none affair. And I think what you're trying to do is to make sure it's only available to the big players. But I don't know if that's, you know, the real reason for these exemptions is to kind of tie it to jobs. And the dollar amount, you know, I'll have to think about that a little bit. The other thing I talked to the sponsor about is I turned to the back of the bill, and I wanted to, I was looking for a sunset date. We have in the past have had sunset dates on these kind of exemptions, because you're really making a stab in the dark. You're kind of exploring new territory, and you don't know if they're going to work or if they're not going to work. And you need to have some kind of an automatic that will encourage the appropriate committee on the legislature to do an in-depth examination of these things. We just had one this morning that we passed on third reading on manufacturing, and we found that just doing some cursory analysis with that one, for example, that it isn't all bad, but we haven't quite done it all right either. So this is a good juncture, a good time to sit back and take a half a day or a day out of an interim study and make sure we've got it cleaned up, so we're not, you know, using this exemption money in a way that doesn't accomplish the original intent. And you know, the sponsor says that, well, the people are interested in this, they don't want any sunset date, or they're not interested in it. Well, I don't like to have a gun held to my head like that. I think that it should be our decision. If we think that we need to look at this, and of course we always can look at it, you know, of course we can do that anytime anyway, but a sunset date gives you that automatic ability to, or I guess an incentive, an automatic incentive to do that. And then when you look at the amendments that were just approved today, I didn't have a real problem so much with them, but if you look at the standing committee amendment under B in both cases, they say, well, you're supposed to turn in a report each year that outlines what the outcomes have been in this thing, and that's good, but that's where it all drops. You know, right now in the Revenue Committee, we get these reports from ethanol industry. We have another one with coal gasification, I think, and there's another one. And the last interim meeting of the last, the last day of the last interim meeting of each year, they pass these reports out to us. One of them is the manufacturing report, and we're going to use the accumulation of these reports that's been established from 2004 to 2009 to make a judgment as to what needs to be fixed in that present exemption. So I think what I'm saying here is that the standing committee amendment is perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned, except there needs to be the next step, and that is the legislature at some point in the future needs to take this information and make use of it. You know, the Revenue Department just preparing these reports and us filing them away in our basements is not really accomplishing anything. There's got to be some overt action to act on them. I don't know about other states, what they're doing. I did hear that the Lone Star State is interested in having this same business we're competing for come to their state. I suppose a lot of other states would too as well. I looked on the computer, and I can't find where the Lone Star State has an exemption for these type of businesses. And that doesn't mean I'm right, but I just haven't found it. I've got a list on my screen over there right now that's got all the equipment exemptions that are listed, and there's none of them that relate to what we're talking about here. So I think, I guess I'd like to urge that the bringer of the bill rethink this sunset on it. I think it's important. I think it's just good business for the legislature to do these kind of things. In other parallel instances, we've done that, and I think that should be considered when we move this on to the next step. Thank you.
Chairman Illaway. Turn your mic on, please.
Excuse me. If I can answer to his satisfaction. My understanding from listening to several of these folks and talking to others, that generally the power rates are profiled for over 20 years. Because it's an enormous building. It's a very expensive undertaking. They're profiled out into the future. And one of the reasons that they're here is because of our power costs. And they've profiled that. So if you end up and put a sunset of X years, I'm not sure that somebody wants to spend, and if I use a figure and it's too large, I apologize, or if it's too small, I apologize. But if you're going to spend $10 to $50 million to put one of these data centers in, and they're not cheap, you don't want to end up with a sunset that shows 4 years or 5 years when you've profiled out the expense of the power and so forth, and you run this out on your calculations. You don't want to end up with an exemption that you just can't live with. So I guess where I'm asking is that we not put an exemption on it. Let's try and see what occurs. There are two facilities that I know of that are interested now. The office downstairs, chief executive's office, it has been supposedly working with somebody else, which is mind-boggling, but I can't answer that question. But I know that putting a sunset on, probably, and if it stayed on through both sides, would probably not looked with favor by any of these companies. As far as looking at the various exemptions, I can remember when I first got into the legislature, we looked at tax exemptions, we've looked at computer, we've looked at everything on there. Some have sunset, some don't. Yes, we probably need to go back and look at that, but I'm not sure that with this particular one that we need to. As far as where these reports go, I'm not on either committee. I'm not a member of the council, of the business council. Those reports come to you. You can ask questions. You can ask people to come in and talk to you. We get reports in Corporations Committee. Yes, we do look at them sometimes. Sometimes we don't because we don't have a problem. So I would ask you, if you don't have any more problems with the bill, you didn't ask one question, and I won't tell you what it was. I'm going to let my cohort over from District 44 to see if there's anything further.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just briefly address a couple of things pointed out from the fine representative from District 40. He referenced what happens if a company doesn't reach the $2 million break point and comes up with the $1,999,000. You know, I believe that if a company has got any wherewithal within them and they see that they're close to that, they'll go out and buy a couple mouse pads or something to put them over the top of that. But that's not the issue at hand here. He also referenced the sunset and lack thereof. Is we're going down a new path, trying to entice these types of businesses to come to Wyoming, and keeping in mind that this $2 million is an ongoing recurring cost. They just don't spend this one time. We have inside here that they're required to keep and maintain this and re-spend this amount of money over and over. So I think to concur with the other representative from Laramie County is we should allow this to at least move along and see what the lack of a sunset does. I don't think that the companies will be beating the door down to come to Wyoming, because they're all going to sit around and see what this body decides to do here, and then they're going to make decisions on whether it's fiscally prudent to even engage in conversations with us. So bearing that in mind, that state that calls itself the Lone Star State, one of the reasons that the companies are not going there and entertaining talks with us is because we do have the things that they're looking for. We have educated population. We have power availability and stability. We have availability to two of the largest and most stable fiber pipes going north, south, east, west in the country. We have all those things that they want. All we have to do is work out some of the details and get them here. Thank you.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a recommendation. Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm getting pretty predictable, but I did want to build on that statement that from the good representative from Cheyenne, because it was so good. And that was what Wyoming has to offer. And I think that's precisely the point, is what Wyoming has to offer. We have no income tax. We have low property taxes. We have low sales taxes. We have a ready supply of electricity at the second cheapest average cost of any state in the United States. We have livable communities. We have low crime rates, good schools, good medical communities. If we can't attract business with those types of assets, I just can't imagine why we would want to add this to it. Add this, which is now changing our philosophy of government, which says we're going to have a government that welcomes business without interference, minimum regulation. It's open for everybody. But now we're saying, except we're going to choose just big data centers, $5 million or more, niche players, small players. You could be easily outcompeted because you are not going to get the tax breaks that the big boys are. So that's the unintended consequences of these exceptions. And I know I must be a minority voice in opposing these, but I think that it's important that people of Wyoming know that we all don't think alike, and that there is a way to have a government that's more even-handed, and we don't have to come down here and pick the winners and losers. So on and against the bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. Represented from the Northern is very right in all those things he said. However, we're competing with a state that does not have an income tax. We can put all these other things together, but we expect that state to offer cash incentives as well. We're not ready to do that. We're going to give them the not only no sales tax, no income tax, no property, or I don't know about property tax, but that state we know is ready to offer other cash incentives to bring this product to their state, we have those other things to balance that out somewhat. And so I'd encourage you a favorable vote on this bill.
Representative Madden.
Yeah, I'm not going to belabor this at all, but profiling power costs for 20 years, you know, that's one thing, but the power company didn't give them a rate for 20 years, and I don't think we need to give them a guaranteed promise that we, no matter, you know, that we're not going to have a sunset on this. I think that, you know, I signed on with this bill as a co-sponsor with the idea that that would be on here by now, and I just think it has to be run by the body once to see where the rest of you feel or where you're at on it. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not to drag this out, but sitting here listening to the debate, lots of good comments, and I think I'm leaning towards the negative side now because the infrastructure in Wyoming for high-speed access to this stuff isn't equal around the state. It pretty much, I think, is along this I-80 corridor in southern Wyoming. So a lot of the other smaller communities in the state don't have the high-speed capabilities that these centers would be looking for. So there really is a competitive disadvantage if some of these smaller local groups want to do a smaller center in some of these smaller communities, they're not going to get the same tax break. So hopefully some amendments can come forward that would allow this even down to some of the lower levels. Again, Wyoming's a great state. Our electrical rates are the lowest in the country or among the lowest in the country. I think, frankly, that's a better area to focus on. It's just keep our electrical rates low. This encourage more power plants using our inexpensive resources within Wyoming and keep that kilowatt hour rate low. If you build it, they will come.
Madam Majority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and fellow colleagues, this is a good piece of legislation. We need to support this piece of legislation. This is legislation that small communities can use. There are many parts of the state. There are many criteria for where you can put a data processing center. And the remoteness of some of the parts of the state, from my part of the state, are very conducive for data centers and for this type of an organization. They don't, and we're very geared up for the technology that's required to handle these types of businesses. They bring good, stable, high-paying jobs to our community. And this is a good piece of legislation that would allow all of us in the state to be competitive in seeking these types of businesses. So on and in favor of this piece of legislation.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on and for the bill. I believe that this is in-state electricity generated in-state at the mine mouth, and we are adding value to that in-state generation of that electricity, and that's a great thing to do. Who knows where it goes from there? You know, this year in the last, 6 months, when one of the largest corporations in America, well, one of the highest per-share trading corporations in America, bought some significant assets, rail, and I thought to myself, we ought to call that guy, and we ought to talk to him about setting up more generating plants and using those. You know, he's obviously vertical integration and horizontal integration and all those things, but this gives us the opportunity to add value to something we produce in state, which we're always struggling to do.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one thing needs to be addressed, and it hasn't been said today. There is what you call a complex that goes together when you start to build technology in an area. This really started at the University of Wyoming with their data center and the broadband that was there. The broadband also goes through the community to the east of it, and the low rates are there. I think as you start to build on the data centers, in-car, the research that will be done with the coal gasification plant that will look at our resources, all of those clusters of things deal in high technology, and once you get critical mass, they will feed on themselves. That's where the Silicon Valleys and that sort of thing came from. They started and grew with a core of value. I think these big ones can do that, and there are benefits to the smaller operators because they can rent and lease places in the larger data centers.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 67 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 67 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Whew. Chairman McComey.
Thank you. Privilege of the floor.
You may have.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House of Representatives, if you have a bill on general file, Friday is the last day to come off general file. You might want to curtail some of your comments and your discussions. Thank you.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 61. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 61, introduced by Representative Throne, an act relating to indigent civil legal services. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, no, Korberg, excused, Throne. The bill was further referred to the Committee of Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, Zeharsh, excused, Philp.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 61 do pass. And I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All the amendment does is we wanted to be consistent throughout the bill. We were using the term civil legal services. Some places in the bill we said services, some places we said civil legal services. So to be consistent, we went through and changed that. Also on page 3, there were some changes as to the language as how the audits would occur. And I would ask for your favorable vote on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Question being called on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. We have a Committee of the Whole. Who's doing the Committee of the Whole amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Where are you? Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could I briefly recap the bill first?
You can.
Thank you. Friends of the 60th, I was here at this very spot approximately 48 hours ago, and I will try not to repeat myself. As I explained, the bill sets up a fund based on a modest increase in various court fees to provide civil legal services. It does not use any general fund money. It will be run by the Supreme Court following rulemaking, and they will report back to the legislature. Since we last visited about the bill, you should have received 2 emails that were sent to the good attorney from over the hill responding to some of his concerns about the bill. And I believe that the judge from Natrona County has made a forceful case for this legal the judge from the middle part of the state. It's getting late. He has made a very strong case for this piece of legislation. Essentially, he points out that it conserves judicial resources to have both parties represented in a lawsuit, that it causes extreme burdens on the judiciary, that there is not a risk of abuse by attorneys when they are contracted for free, because again, in a civil domestic dispute, both the husband and the wife should qualify for civil legal services, so we're not creating more risk of one party being unrepresented. And in the end, if we don't provide these legal services to folks, and the vast majority of these cases are going to be in domestic relations, I can't tell you how many constituents I've heard from who were unrepresented in a divorce, and it causes problems later for their children. This is why we need this bill. It will help folks entitled to rights survive the legal system. It's supported by a wide array of practicing attorneys, by a wide array of members of the bar, and certain individuals involved in this effort have been researching this issue for 10 years. The time has come. Wyoming is one of only two states that does not provide civil legal services. Our low and moderate income citizens need to have their rights protected in court. So I would urge your support for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Stupson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to withdraw Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has been removed. We're on to Committee Amendment of the Whole Number 2. Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 and ask for your favorable consideration. There are reporting requirements within the bill in terms of what is planned for the program, and there are reporting requirements for what the proposed budget might be, but I do have some concerns about this proposal, and I would feel a little bit better if we would adopt this amendment and say that after the program gets going, we can look back and reflect on how the program is working, and I would do that with the suggested amendment on page 2, line 22, and just insert the language that each biennial plan submitted under this subsection, beginning with the biennial commencing July 1, 2012, shall include case statistics and program costs for the preceding biennium. So this would couple what's already required in the bill to say, this is what we plan on doing. If you adopt this amendment, this would say, this is what we did do. So I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Any further discussion on Committee Amendment Number 2, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2? Representative Throne.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to call for the question. Thank you.
Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 is passed. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3, Representative Stupson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move for Committee of Whole Amendment Number 3 and ask for your favorable consideration. And this is really a shaved-down version of what was Committee of the Whole Number 1. And what it does essentially is looks at another source of funding, an additional source of funding for the legal services program that I think makes sense. And essentially what it would do is for those punitive damages awards around the state, 25% of the state would be entitled to 25% of those awards, and they would flow into the fund created by this bill. And I do that for a couple reasons, and I think it's important to understand a little bit about punitive damages and the policies behind those. But remember, punitive damages are just what they sound like. They're to punish. And they are not to answer the damages of any particular party, but they are really a court-sanctioned method to punish a bad actor. And they're only available if a defendant acts willfully and wantonly. It's not available for any defendant. It's only if you're intentionally acting in a really bad way, then you get then a plaintiff may have punitive damages available. And the way that they're figured is you'll go through and, you know, they'll figure out how the plaintiff was hurt, whether, you know, if there's a wrongful death, they'll figure out those damages, bodily injury, property injury, lost wages, even pain and suffering, all those things, all those elements that are meant to compensate a plaintiff are taken care of. And then after that, punitive damages are considered. And they are solely, it has no relationship whatsoever to the plaintiff's injuries. It is solely related to the amount of culpability by the defendant. And so it really, in effect, ends up being a windfall to the plaintiff that they get because of just the reprehensible conduct of a defendant. And so you have a plaintiff that uses the court system. That court system results in a windfall. It seems to me like that is a good place to look for funds to help those that can't afford, those the most desperate in our society, they can't afford any legal services. And so you take just a portion of that windfall and you plug it into the legal services fund, and it can be used for those folks that can't afford their own legal services. So I think it's a solid policy basis for looking at punitive damages to fund this, but I would be open for any questions or comments.
Representative Love now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the amendment, I agree with 92.5% of everything the good representative from Natrona County said. The problem is that punitive damages are private property. They're owned by the plaintiff. And we're either doing one of two things here. We're either doing a tax for the use of the court of 25% of your proceeds as taxation, which violates, I think, some of the constitutional provisions, and I didn't get them all researched, or it's just a taking of private property. And it says in our Constitution, Article 1, Section 32, that private property shall not be taken for private use, which is what this is, funding legal services, by consent of the owner, except for private ways of necessity, for reservoirs, drains, flumes, ditches across lands of others, or for agricultural, mining, milling, domestic, or sanitary purposes, or in any case without due compensation. So what we do is we set ourselves up for the taking of somebody's private property for private use. And then we don't apply the tax equally. We just apply the tax to those folks who are really hurt. Now, I do agree that punitive damages are a windfall. And I do agree that they are to punish bad conduct. And I do agree that the victim of that bad conduct gets those punitive damages. I will also tell you that punitive damages are very rarely awarded in Wyoming. But this seems just a bad piece of public policy to me that we would take somebody's private property and use it for a public use just because it's a windfall.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions of the sponsor and on, and I think opposed to Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3. First question would be, would the 25% come out prior to the plaintiff's attorney's contingency collection of 40-50% or more? And the second question would be, would it ever happen, I doubt in Wyoming, but could it ever happen, I guess, that a court could make an excessive judgment just to fill the coffee can?
Representative Stupson.
Mr. Chairman, let me answer, I guess, those questions and concerns in turn. First, this assertion that this is a taking of private property, this is property that only arises because of the use of the court system. It does not exist but for the use of government resources and the court system. It therefore makes sense that you're not taking all of it. You're taking 25% of this, what is admittedly a windfall, and using it to fund access to that same court system by those that can't afford it. That is not a taking of private property. There are not constitutional concerns with this. It is done across the country. A number of other jurisdictions, in fact, our friends down in the Sunshine State take half of all punitive awards, and they just send it to the general fund. So this is not either radical nor is it unconstitutional. With respect to whether the attorney's fees are considered when you're taking the 25% or not, I guess that depends upon the nature of the agreement you have with your attorney. And they have different agreements, whether it be the gross award or the net award, and that's sort of a matter between the client and the attorney that they agree to. And finally, I don't think this fuels runaway awards because it is the jury that determines the amount of the punitive damage to award, and the jury doesn't get to find out where the punitive damages is going. You don't instruct the jury that they're funding legal services for indigent folks. And so I don't think that's a danger either. Instead, what you have is the same process you have in our state right now. Only 25% of that windfall goes to fund indigent legal services.
Representative Love now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a correction to what the good representative from Natrona County said. There are occasions in every civil trial where you can waive the jury and just have a trial to a judge only. And so the jury doesn't have to know because there is no jury. The judge just decides what that punitive damage award may be. Now, I don't anticipate, given the quality of our judiciary in Wyoming, that the risk that the other good representative from Natrona County says, that a judge awards a huge punitive damage award just to fill the coffers of the fund, is going to happen. But I still disagree based upon the language of the Wyoming Constitution. And this is property of the plaintiff, and we're taking it away, and that's not right.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one brief question for the bringer. It's been suggested or testified that punitive damages are rarely awarded in Wyoming. If that is the case, would this be a sustaining source of funds for the indigent legal services?
Representative Stupson.
Mr. Chairman, it depends on the year and the kind of cases being brought in a given year, and that's why I think you don't want to rely exclusively upon this method to fund these services, because you could see huge swings up and down from year to year on how much money would be flowing from this provision into those services. And that's why I backed off on any discussion about cutting the set fee, because we do want to make sure that there is a stable and predictable amount of funds going into this fund.
Any further discussion? Question being called. We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3. All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3 has failed. We're back on the bill. Representative Throne. Question being called. All of those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 61 do pass. All of those in favor, please say aye. Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill Number 61 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 15. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 15, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to electrical safety and fire prevention. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Kimball, Lubno, Miller, Stupson, Swanitzer, Dan, signed, representing Illaway, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, excused, Philp. Signed, representing Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill Number 15 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. and to explain the bill, standing committee amendment, and so forth, is the good young gentleman from House District 43.
Representative is Wanitzer Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to walk you through House Bill 15, Electrical Safety and Fire Prevention Revisions. I will probably cover the standing amendment as we go through the bill, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman. And I will try to be quick and efficient, but it is kind of a long bill. This bill came about because of an internal management audit of the State Fire Marshal's Office in 2007. And so the revisions have been studied for several years by the Corporations Committee, and we're pleased to present them today. Section 1, to walk you through the bill, the creation statutes, we are basically giving the investigation of electrocutions power to the chief electrical inspector of the state, which is housed in the state fire marshal's office. He now will have the power to investigate electrocutions as long as there's not already applicable federal law, federal jurisdiction. And if you look on the standing committee amendments from lines 4 through 6, we also amended in that he doesn't have authority when the entity involved is regulated by the Public Service Commission. There's some concern in that regard, so we amended that in. To walk you through what his powers are, basically the chief electrical inspector will now be able to enter or examine any property or building where an electrocution occurred, any nearby or adjacent property where an electrocution occurred. Basically, he has custody of the building and premises until the examination are completed. He can take testimony under oath, he can subpoena witnesses, administer oaths, and finally, if there is criminal activity, he transmits a copy of this to the district attorney in the county. I probably should say county or district attorney where the incident occurred. That's the new language. The rest of this is amending current law all through Section 2. Most of these have to do with the definition of the board versus the department, and we're giving the department more power as the board only meets four times a year. Quickly, the next major jump, as I go through quickly, we're on page 6 and 35.9103, allowing the board to appoint a vice chairman. Under the duties of the council in 35.9106, we are now adding in the International Existing Building Code as one of the standards the Fire Marshal's Office uses. That's really what it's called, the International Existing Building Code. And then we're basically also allowing the council to have full discretion under conducting investigations. They're on lines 11 through 15 on page 7. 359108P is for aggrieved owner appeals, and 359117 is for an order to remove combustible material. Those will now go to the council for hearings. 359107 is all cleanup language for the duties and powers of the state fire marshal. What this bill really gets at is in 359108 on page 8. We're basically now allowing, if code deficiencies are discovered through inspection by the fire marshal's office when you're building or remodeling a building, we can amend to bring the building into compliance with the applicable codes. Before that, we found the problem was after you finish the building, the state fire marshal's office says yes or no. This way, if they do find a violation, they work with the builder or the remodeler to amend the plan review as they go, which is kind of what has been done unstatutorily or unofficially over the years, but we're putting in a statute just so everybody knows. We're then adding amended plan review into Section N on page 9. Moving quickly through the rest of the bill, we are raising the dollar limit on page 10, Romanet 2, from the $25,000 limit to the $40,000 limit based on remodeling costs when they have to do an inspection. We're then allowing the same for the fees there in Romanet 3. We also are now in subsection S allowing plan reviews to be submitted in phases, so actually you can submit an initial plan, start work, and then amend and finalize in steps as you go instead of building the whole thing and finding out you were wrong. 359119 on page 10 goes into the duties of the chief electrical inspector. Basically, again, this is to investigate electrocution incidents. Then in subsection C, we're amending this in. This is actually language already on the law, but we moved it to this section. And you'll see in the standing committee amendment on lines 13 through 15 on page 11, we've taken that part out. There's some concern in committee from the general public, and it's a pretty standard statute throughout our laws everywhere, but we believed we'd just take it out there in committee. 359120, minimum requirements for installations. Currently, we go by the electrical code. We are now adding in all sorts of other informational tools the state fire marshal's office can use, like the International Fire Code, the International Building Code, International Mechanical Code, but basically what we're saying is if it contradicts with what, if like two of these publications contradict with one another, the National Electrical Code trumps all. We are raising the permit fees. They're on line 16 on page 12, from $30 to $50. It's been 17 years. Cost of business has gone up. Jumping quickly through the rest of the bill, these fees, statutory, we're changing the structure. It used to be 50-50. We're going to go to 60-40. So 60% will now go for additional state electrical inspectors. There are three in the state that get paid from the 60% fund. 40% of the fees are going to go to the general fund. Skipping to the bottom of page 15, basically this Romanet 3 mandates that if you request a code officer, they have to be certified. If it's the authority for fire and building codes, you have to have a certified fire and building code inspector. Same with Romanet 4 on page 16. If it's an electrical code enforcement activity is requested, you have to have a certified person. Subsection V, if any municipality or county that has been granted local enforcement authority, they have to have at least one, if not multiple, depending on your municipality or county, holding a certificate of all time. The authority reverts to the state should they lose that license or they leave the department, and it basically is the responsibility now of that municipality or county who has local jurisdiction to inform the state should someone leave their office in that case. Page 17 is where most of the standing committee amendment comes into place. The first one you'll see is on page 17, line 13. This basically deals when municipalities have enforcement authority under their appeals board. What we're finding a lot, or at least several places throughout Wyoming, you go to a building inspector, they determine a permit one way or another. You don't like that, and you go to the appeals board, except the chief building inspector of that jurisdiction is the head of the appeals board, which doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. So we're just adding that the person making the decision on the appeals board can't be the person who gave you the original ruling for or against you in your favor. After that, moving on to subsection E, we're also adding the standing committee amendments from lines 24 in the standing committee amendment through 26 that we are going to reallow a decision of the council to be appealed to the State Council on Fire Prevention and Electrical Safety should you have a disagreement on the appeals board. What you're finding is if you don't agree with the appeals board, your next step is district court. It can take 3 to 6 months. Those people who are building in this state, the cost of business is astronomical for someone to wait 6 months on getting their building coded and up to proper codes to open. Then again, in the standing committee amendment on lines 30 to 33, we're adding in that any appeal to a local board has to be within 30 days for appeal. We're also finding that sometimes it takes 6 to 9 months for one of these appeals to take place right now. Again, with the cost of doing business, having to wait is an astronomical cost to many builders in the state. The only other, that's the standing committee amendment. The other part of the standing committee amendment on line 35 deals with page 20. Everything in Romanet 1 from lines 1 through 20 is in another bill going through the body right now, so we felt best to take it out of this bill so they wouldn't contradict with one another. And then the last major thing of this bill is on subsection C on page 20, where the board shall suspend or cancel the license. We currently have the word flagrant violation. No one quite knew what flagrant was, so we've made it a repeated or serious violation. And then on the top of page 21, we've defined what a repeat or serious violation is. The rest of the bill, not to bore you, is just conforming language or clarification on what the power of the department versus the power of the board shall be. At this point, I'd ask if there are any questions on the standing committee amendment that I explained. And if there's not, I call for the question on that.
Question being called on standing committee amendment number 1. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number 1 is passed the committee of the whole. We're on.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to present the committee of the whole amendment number 1 to House Bill 15 that has my name on it. Basically, if you go back to page 17, line 21, this was my intent in committee when I took this out, and somehow it didn't make it into the bill. Basically, we're taking out the words regarding state-owned or leased. So it's not only if you have an appeal based on a state-owned or state-leased building. This will be if you have any building where you have a problem with the appeals board. We give you the option to take it to the state board on fire prevention, electrical safety, instead of jumping to district court. You don't have to do that step, but I do think it would be a good step for arbitration and less costly. And so I'd move the committee of the whole amendment number 1 and stand for questions at this time on that.
Question being called on committee of the whole amendment number 1. All those in favor of committee of whole amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the whole amendment number 1 has passed the committee of the whole. We're back to the bill.
Question on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 15 do pass. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 15 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for
Chairman, we're going to put in 106 after 109.
Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 109. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 109, introduced by Representative Hammonds, an act relating to compulsory school attendance. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Connolly, Kraft, Yagi, Lubnow, McKim, McComey, No, Brechtel, Dirks, Teeters. Signed, Representative Lubnow, Vice Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 109 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to the good lady from the land of just above the hot springs, and she will explain the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill. Thank you.
Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the garden capital of the state, I'm here to bring you House Bill 109. Thank you to the good chairman. There is a standing committee amendment, but it will make more sense if I read it integrated into the bill. The bill itself is a paragraph, and so I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to simply walk you through the bill itself, which, as I said, is one paragraph, so that you'll have a complete understanding of how it works. And then hopefully after you pass the Standing Committee Amendment, I'll give you the explanations about why Wyoming would need this particular bill. But if you turn to me on page 1 of House Bill 109, it says, in addition to subsection A of this section, the parent, guardian, or other person having control or charge of any child under the age of 18... To remind you, this is the bill dealing with those kids who want to drop out of school and their parents giving their consent. The first part mentions the age of 18, and that's because by Wyoming law, you have permission from the state of Wyoming to drop out at the age of 16 and no longer attend school. This first phrase means that those children are minors and, as such, are the responsibility of their parents. This does not change the age at which a child may drop out of school in Wyoming. That age remains 16 and older until the age of 18, because when they turn 18, they are legally adults and they're responsible for themselves. And so the first part is simply addressing that the parents are responsible for these children because they are minors in the eyes of the law in Wyoming. The next phrase, shall meet in person. The reason I have that in there is because some kids have been known to forge their parents' signature.
No.
And so I want these parents to meet in person.
No.
Yes. The next phrase, with a school district counselor or administrator. Now, you will note it does not say it has to be on school property. It simply says that they have to meet with a school district counselor or administrator. The reason I put that in there is I felt that those individuals would be the ones most able to respectfully deal with the situation. I did not want the parent to just drop it off with a secretary. I feel this is one of the more significant decisions that a parent or a child may make, and I hope they would make that sign with a counselor or a school administrator, someone who's capable of dealing with this profound moment in the life of that child. The last part is, of course, to provide the school district with written consent to the withdrawal of that child from school attendance. And that is the language we use, which you and I might all call dropout, but it is withdrawal from school. The amendment goes in right after 18. And this was worked on with an attorney from Washington, D.C. that represents many of the parents in this state whose children are educated outside of our public school system. And that amendment simply states that After 18, it would say, who has not otherwise notified the district of enrolling that child in a different school district or in a private school or a home-based educational program. And as you know, the children that are not enrolled in our public schools, their parents already do this. They notify the district. Usually it's at the superintendent's office that's where they do that notification. And so this just conforms and allows for the fact that that already is an ongoing process. And so with that, I would move adoption of the amendment as proposed.
Question being called on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're back on the bill. Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I want to, one of the first questions that people often ask me is, well, what happens if the parent doesn't sign? What happens is we have existing statutes that deal with that. And it's a question of truancy when the child isn't in school. And their parent hasn't signed for them to withdraw from school. We have all the steps are outlined in existing statutes. Interestingly, I don't think I could do a better job writing that statute today. The number one step that happens once the school is aware of it is that the attendance officer counsels with the parents, the student, and the teachers to try to come up with a solution for the situation. And that's what existing statutes allow for. What I want to talk to you next about, though, is why would we want to adopt something like this? And I think in my introduction, when I asked for your support for the introduction of the bill, I talked about asking for consistency in our statutes that deal with minors. Currently, parents are asked to give their consent if their children get driver's licenses, if they want to get married. In Wyoming, it's at the age of 16. You need your parents' consent. Even if you want to get your ears pierced or any other part of your body pierced, I suppose, tattoos, body art, that kind of thing, it says it in statute that you need that parental consent. And so this allows for that kind of consistency. Wyoming views these young people as minors, and as such, the law says that their parents are responsible for them, and I believe this most significant moment the parent should be signing. The second reason that I think it's important that we address it is that the way it exists right now, parents are not a part of this legally. I was talking to a parent at one of our receptions, and they said, as astounding as this may seem to all of you, and you actually know all know this individual, their daughter dropped out of school at 16. She was a sophomore. They didn't know it for 2 weeks. And you can say, well, how would a parent not know that? Well, once your kid gets old enough to drive and everybody gets up and goes to work and you're going your ways, they didn't know for 2 weeks. The school is not legally obligated to call you because a 16-year-old can choose to drop out and not attend school. And so I think that at this critical juncture in a young person's life, their parents should participate in that decision. The next thing that I think it's important, and this is from my personal experience as an educator, as a teacher, I don't care what you call it, I'm a teacher, was a teacher. It's the power of parents working with schools and the power of schools working with parents that is the most effective thing we can do for these young people. When you have that teamwork of parents and teachers saying, what can we do? What can we do together working with those students? It makes a difference. How many kids do we hear say, no one cared that I didn't come? Is this a critical moment in their life? You bet it is. But when parents work with schools, it can make a profound difference for them. This is a tool for both parents and for schools. It's supported by principals, by the superintendents, by teachers, by the agency that oversees education, and a leading business organization in the state of Wyoming. They all support this concept. Now, the bottom line for me, I can give you economic choices. They'll say that in 2008 that $484 million were lost in lifetime earnings by this group of young people. That when they would grow up and have a lifetime of earning in Wyoming, that's the difference, $500 million. So I can persuade some of you with economics. For me, it's about each individual student and the profound disadvantage they are at in their lives when they make this choice. What are the numbers in our state? The numbers in our state are between 73% and 79% of our kids graduate. That means between 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 are dropping out. That's a profound loss. Between 20% and, okay, let me do it in my head, 27% of our kids. From my perspective, they're lost. Sure, some of them come back and some of them end up being successful, but oh my, the cost to all of us when we let them slip through. And I think for many of you, you think a dropout is a young guy with an attitude. Well, 45% of our dropouts are young women. And the correlation with them dropping out and becoming young mothers is very, very high. So what happens? Statistically, when those young women drop out and become unwed mothers, and they become the parents of these children, those children statistically have the greatest statistical reason to end up being dropouts themselves. It is a cycle that never ends. And that's why every year I keep bringing back something to stop the dropout issue. It's because how do we stop the cycle? We stop the cycle by helping people graduate. It's as simple as that. I found this list of statistics, and the numbers don't tell it, but this is a generalization, and I thought that it really would help you. It's all backed up with data. High school graduates provide both economic and social benefits to society. In addition to earning higher wages, high school graduates live longer. They're less likely to be teen parents. High school graduates are also less likely to commit crimes, rely on government health care, use public services such as food stamps or housing assistance. Think of the cost of all of those programs to all of us. But last of all, and for those of you who believe in an educated population in order to have a sound democracy, this is so critical. High school graduates engage in civic activity, including voting and volunteering in their communities and at higher levels. The future of our state is based on educating our young people. Why wouldn't we ask that parents be allowed to sign in order for their children to drop out of high school? And for that reason, I would hope you would support House Bill 109.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I want to just say how much I appreciate the impassioned presentation supported by data and philosophy. It shows the power of a true believer, and it isn't that nice to be able to come up here and have a proposal that you can believe in so strongly. I did have a question that you did address right at the very first part of the presentation, good representative from Warland area, and that, but I didn't quite understand the consequences, and that was, it seems to me like a number of these individuals, children who would drop out, would not have the parent at and would not have an adult involved in their lives. And I can't quite tell what would happen to them. And I wondered whether or not you considered or whether the committee considered if that individual child would also have the opportunity to come in and talk with a school counselor or administrator representing themselves if they didn't have a parent or guardian or other person in their lives.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have questions. My questions are also kind of just in the body of the bill. So notifying a parent to come down, what if the parent is not responding to the notification? Does the school notify two or three times by phone? What happens if the parent doesn't want to come? Parent refuses to sign. And then if you could walk through the consequences a little better, so the truancy officer comes, what if this starts at age 16? Are they going to chain him to the seat from the age 16 to 18? Does the child go through the process of emancipation? I mean, what happens at this? Generally, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of educators. When you get to this point, things are not going well and haven't been going well for some time. I don't think there's a single person here that does not disagree with you about education, about graduation, about how incredibly important it is. And all of us would love to see the graduation rate in Wyoming improve. I'm not certain this is the vehicle to do it. But so explain to me what happens. How is the parent notified? What if the parent doesn't come in? How many times does the school try? Do they just give up? And then if this does happen, a little more about truancy. How does that work? Do they get, you know, picked up by the truancy officer? How long does this process continue?
Representative Peters.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is well-intentioned, but it's a lot like trying to prevent a car accident after it's already happened. If a child has gotten to the point where they've decided that they're checking out, I'm not sure that a parent or the school can keep that child in school and be able to effectively teach them. I think we need to focus our attention on the front end, and that is through developing programs and initiatives to try and prevent people from getting to the point where they're ready to drop out. I don't see that this bill is going to help our dropout rate, and I struggle with the philosophy behind it, not the intention behind it, because I think the intention behind it is good. I'm just not sure that it's going to make a difference.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking on and in favor of this bill, I think one thing that we really want to understand is this isn't an idea of let's get the kid, let's drag the parents in, and let's talk like blue devils to get them to stay in school. That isn't the idea. The idea is to, number one, as the good representative mentioned, make parents aware. But, you know, speaking as an old school counselor for an awful lot of years, I would love that opportunity to tell kids options if they do choose to leave. I'm not going to try to convince them to do something they've already decided they're not going to do, but I would love to tell them about GED programs, options programs, dual and concurrent enrollment programs. I come from a county, my particular school district enjoys one of the very highest dropout rates in the state. We have a wonderful alternative program that's kind of the alternative to the alternative school. Do you know how many kids are enrolled in that program right now? Seven. In an entire building that could house 60. And it's because we can't get the information to the people that need it the most. The kids. I think the idea of a kid coming in on his own, his or her own, if a parent's not available is a great idea. There are some good questions that were asked. But I really want you to consider that this is not desperately beating them over the head to stay in school. This is giving them options, giving them ideas, giving them help so that maybe they can get a diploma or a GED in an alternate way and think about this decision that's going to impact the rest of their lives. On and for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like the opportunity to answer the questions, and they are thought-provoking, and I think it's something that we all need to think about. As I said, this fits into existing statutes that are well spelled out. I want to first address my good friend over the Bighorns. Am I allowed to say Bighorns? Maybe not. Over the beautiful mountains to the – I can say Bighorns. Okay. If they don't have an adult in their life and they're 16 years old, I think we need to know that. They're a minor out there. The current laws deal with notification of parents or whoever's in control, assuming that a minor child has someone in control. At a certain point, it is the school attendance officer does notify the authority, usually in it, the county, it's the county attorney. And so I do think that minor children who have no one in control of them, that should be something the authorities know about. And I would certainly hope that we could work with them. I don't know how many of you saw the movie at Christmas time with the beautiful star that my husband said that had the tightest skirts he had just about ever seen, and he really liked the movie a lot. But that family adopted that outstanding athlete, and that young man didn't really have any parent who could assign something. But I would like to think that our society in Wyoming wants to know if there are minors out there who don't have anyone to help them, and then to work with them through our legal processes. The next question happened with, and I don't know if the asker of the question is within hearing distance. So my good friend from this area, how are the parents notified? Actually, this is an issue, even though we have the statutes, it is an issue of local control. Each school district has their own procedures for how they handle it. They have an attendance officer, whether it's a counselor in their district or whatever, that it's their duty. You know, often it's an attendance secretary who keeps track of who's in school and who's not. And then they notify the parents. If there are a number of notifications, at some point it is turned over to the county attorney, and it's their responsibility to see what's going on. And that begins the process of the attendance officer then counseling with the family. But it is a question of local control, and believe me, each of our communities deal with this in a different way, and many of them has to do with how seriously they're taking the dropout issue. But those are all in current statutes. That is not something that I am changing. The next one, with my good friend from the southeast corner of the state, talking about it's a car accident after it's happened. It's not. I mean, they're 16, but they're not grown up. They want somebody to care about them. When you look them in the eyes and you try to work with them, they want somebody who cares. It's not over. We don't give up on people when they're 16. We still try to work with them. The car accident hasn't already happened. Sure, there are disappointments and there are patterns, but these are young people. We're working like the devil to help in this state. We are really trying to do what we can. And I agree absolutely, totally, we should focus on the front end. And we are. My goodness, look at all the programs we have for at-risk kids in this state and how many people have dedicated their lives to working with them. We are doing that. But it was contended that this won't help the dropout rate. Well, if it helps, what? How many kids do we have to say that we help in order to make it worth voting yes today? Would you want to help just one kid? Do you want to help 100? There are 1,400 kids who drop out annually in Wyoming. What do you consider important enough that we could do? Because that one person will go live the rest of their life, and they'll have children, and that pattern will continue, that cycle of creating more dropouts. I think it'll help the dropout rate, because I think it'll help individuals, and it'll help our parents work with their children, their minor children, accept that responsibility. It's not going to solve the problem, but it is one step in the right direction, I believe.
Question being called. All of those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that do so with a recommendation that House Bill 109 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 109 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The Majority Floor Leader has moved House Bill 106 to the next bill. It's not on your list. So if
we're going to, Mr. Chairman, sorry to interrupt, but I thought that last one would not take quite as long, but I'm glad that it did, and that's okay, but my timing was a little bit off, so I'm going to move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 18, amended. And further amended. and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 67, amended. And further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 61. Amended. Recommended, do pass. House Bill 15. Amended. And further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 109. Amended. Recommended, do pass. Signed, Representative Moniz, Chairman.
Representative Moniz.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of Whole Report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Report is adopted. Thank you, Representative Moniz. Nice job. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 122, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 9, Juvenile Detention Facility Standards. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 123, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 18, Limited Liability Companies Revisions, Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 124, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 22, State Active Duty Medical Expense Reimbursement, Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 125, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 31, Federal Natural Resources Policy Account. Ayes 27, noes 3. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 126. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 37, Omnibus Water Bill Construction. Ayes 30, noes 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 127. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 42, School Finance Student Enrichment Instruction. Ayes 20, noes 10. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 128. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 51, Official State Code. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 129. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 63, Irrigation District Assessments. Ayes 30, noes 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 130. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 26, Eligibility Concealed Weapons Permit. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 75, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representing Quarburg, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 83, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bagby, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Quarburg, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 94, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ives, Begbie, Barbuto, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Quarburg, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 95, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ives, Begbie, Barbuto, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg. Excused, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 113, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Peasley, Quarburg. No, Barbuto, Patton. Excused, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 72, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, excused, Philp, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number six, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 47, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Childers, Davison, Yagi, Shepperson. No, Connolly, Millen, Thompson. Absent, Brown. Signed, Representative Yagi, Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. Committee announcements, Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number six, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Friday morning, February the 19th at 8 a.m. in room H10 to consider the following bills. Senate File 10, Engrossed, State Parks, Bear River State Park. Senate File 11, State Parks, Acquisition and Disposition of Lands. Senate File 12, Engrossed, State Parks and Historic Sites, Boundaries and Designations.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number seven, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, at noon recess. We're going to discuss the continuation of House Bill 128, Health Insurance Interstate Purchase. We'll discuss House Bill 34, Referendum on Adopted Ordinance Petitions, House Bill 39, Insurance Benefits, Usual, Customary, and Reasonable. And if there's time, Senate File 4, Special District Elections, and Senate File 5, Engrossed, Special Districts Public Records.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number one, Judiciary, will meet at 8 a.m. in room H8 to hear House Bill 91, Governmental Immunity Waiver for Hospital Whistleblowers, House Bill 80, Peace Officers, Detention Officers, and Dispatchers, and House Bill 132, Homicide During Pregnancy Number 2.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number four, Education, will meet now, immediately upon adjournment, up in H-10, to take up House Bill 120, Student Assessment Measures.
Vice Chairman Stetson.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number nine on Minerals, Business, and Economic Development will meet tomorrow at 7:30 a.m. in room H-18 to discuss House Bill 79, Eminent Domain Wind Power Collector Lines, House Bill 89, Resident Contractor Preferences, House Bill 85, Economic Development Reporting, House Bill 92, Predatory Lending, and House Bill 130, Impact Assistance for Wind Energy Facilities.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number five, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning starting at 7 a.m. in room 302 to continue hearing House Bill 54, Wyoming Food Freedom Act. We will also consider House Joint Resolution 10, Resolution Primacy of Wyoming's Water Rights, House Bill 114, Partition Fences, and House Bill 122, Disposal of Livestock. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Committee number eight on Highways, Transportation, and Military Affairs will meet tomorrow night, Thursday, February 18th, immediately upon adjournment in room H-17 to discuss House Bill 81, Safe Transportation of Railroad Employees, and House Bill 73, Safety on Railroads.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10 will meet upon adjournment in room H-17 to hear House Bill 119, Public Health Nurses, and House Bill 63, Tanning Salons Minors.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Appropriations Committee number 2 has reviewed House Bill 93, and it does not need to be in our committee, so I'd like to re-refer that back to the Committee of the Whole, House Bill 93.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered.
Okay. And then following up on that, Mr. Speaker, we will meet tomorrow morning, Thursday, at 8 a.m. in room 204 to hear House Bill 111, Electric Transmission Consideration of Regional Issues, and House Bill 97, Nuclear Energy Production Study. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Chairman McComey, re-referrals.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, would like to re-refer Senate File 45, School Bus Seatbelts, to the Transportation Committee, your committee number 8.
Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Representative Stepson.
Mr. Speaker, may I have privilege of the floor?
Please proceed.
Mr. Speaker, the good chairman of Minerals wanted me to remind everybody that the legislative prayer breakfast will be tomorrow morning at 6:30 at the Egg and I. And if you're planning to attend, please let Representative Lockhart know.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, after we adjourn, Representative Thompson will lead us in Cowgirl Joe. So, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until February 18, 2010 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The House is adjourned until Thursday morning, February 18, 2010 at 10 a.m. Representative Thompson.